Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 15th of September 2013. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Julie Raby, Gareth James, and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about the ritual slaughter of George Mastromas at the Royal Court. This is a new play by Dennis Kelly. In fact, it's his Royal Court debut. The production is directed by Vicky Featherstone, the new artistic director of the theatre. It tells the story of a young man called George Mastromas, has been promised during the 70s, and becomes a major capitalist figure in the 80s and 90s, basically when he introduces himself to three rules of his life. Take whatever you want, lie as much as you can to get there, and be prepared to take the consequences, essentially be prepared to take the consequences of your lies. He discovers these rules and they shape his life as a rather vicious capitalist. But he starts off as a rather nice guy who always tries to do the right thing, but always seems to think that he's doing the cowardly thing. I was quite impressed by this play. I thought it was incredibly well written. Initially, we have a lot of essentially narration. I think about the first half hour is a group of people sitting on chairs and just telling you what's going on, telling you the story of George Mastromas' early life. And then we finally start getting into individual scenes, but people still come on stage and interrupt. And it's very chatty. And I like this, but I have to say one of the problems with this play, as much as I liked it, was it is way too long. You could have taken at least half an hour out of it, I think. I'm not entirely sure where you would wield the blue pencil, but it needed to be cut down. It was wordy, it was incredibly wordy, and you wanted a lot more action. But I think it tells a good story and an interesting one. The cast, as George Mastromas, we have Tom Brooke, and he's joined by Pippa Hayward, Joshua James, Cato Flynn, Alan Williams, Aaron Monahan, and Jonathan McGuinness. So it's a pretty top-notch cast, and I think they all did extremely well. In fact, I was especially pleased with Tom Brooke. He seemed to be, I don't know, more rounded. Usually, I seem to associate him with playing sort of weedy, weak characters, and this is somebody playing somebody a lot more normal, and I was rather pleased with that. Julie, tell me what you thought about this play.
To be honest, I'm not sure yet. I saw it last night, so I haven't really had time to digest it. I think when I was trying to work out whether I liked it or didn't like it, I was actually thinking, well, I didn't hate it. It didn't wow me, but I'm glad I went. I liked the beginning bit with all the characters on stage doing the story, and I liked the Tristram Shandy thing about it. You know, this rambling story about somebody's life where actually you're not getting to the point for quite a while. But I just thought sometimes things weren't developed, so the nice guy bit wasn't really developed. And I thought they could have been a bit more subtle about how far would you go, because in a way it was kind of obvious. It wasn't a surprise at times. The bit at the end, though, confused me slightly. I was with somebody, and I said, if he was born in 1974, how old was he when he had a grandson? So maybe it was a future world, was it? This kind of bleak cosmos, the idea that
I thought it was a long time in the future, yeah.
Yeah, he represented some kind of universe rather than a person, and that was where the world was going or something like that. I wasn't quite sure about that. I'd be interested to hear what you think.
Phil, what did you think about this?
Well, I can only tell you what I thought about the first act because I left. I found that first half hour really tedious. People were laughing occasionally at bits of it. They obviously found bits of it funny, but it didn't make me laugh at all. I didn't really think we needed to know so much backstory. And I think in a play, it's just tell but not show. I didn't really see why we needed quite so much backstory. I could understand there was a sort of a sliding doors type moment in the story where a decision is made, and then in the first scene where it becomes the actual play itself, in the sense that we actually see what's happening, there's a sliding doors moment in that way where he sort of makes a decision and that affects the rest of his life, whether to be sort of good or evil, basically. And it's a sort of Faustian pact. I think it was a big mistake to have a clock on stage, although it was obviously there was a point to it because the woman he makes the pact with sort of stops time, which was kind of quite strange. But I was watching the clock during that, even though I thought that was the best scene in it, well, of the scenes that I saw. I only booked to see this because of Tom Brooks. I really like him. I think it's physically, he didn't really convince me that he was such an evil person, because I think he's got a face of a person who looks like somebody you want to mother him, you want to look after him. But I just found so much of the writing really irritating. When the other characters aren't playing a specific role, they come on as this sort of Greek chorus, and they keep repeating the line, which, God, if you want to cut some of the running time, cut those lines and cut half of that first half hour as well. I really didn't care about anybody and I just wanted to leave. And I think, you know, if you're saying something about capitalism, it's a bit kind of, capitalism's bad. We get that.
I must admit, I think the first half, I enjoyed bits of it, but it was too long, especially that first scene. And when we went, people were laughing at it. And I think I enjoyed the kind of batting back and forward. But we've seen that recently, haven't we? It's not something new. It's something the Republic of Happiness was trying to do, that idea that you don't know who's going to say the next line, and they take each line and move it on. So I think, yeah, it was too long in the end, but it was nice to have a shorter second half.
This is actually a fairly old play. I mean, it's been done in Frankfurt, I think, a few years ago. So it's been done before in Germany, and it's a slightly changed play for it. I agree with most of the points, but I did find myself enjoying it and just living with it, although I knew it was too long. The only one that gave me the problems, and I think has confused one or two of the reviewers of this, is the scene where he tricks the woman into falling in love with him by pretending to have been abused. The problem with that is that you don't know how much of the setup he is, because it looks as if he's gambling away all his money and then suddenly he's rich all over again, and it didn't quite make sense, unless of course he was lying about, you know, gambling away all his money, or not. It's a business gamble rather than a gamble. We're now going to talk about Much Ado About Nothing at the Old Vic. This is the Shakespeare play, and it stars James Earl Jones and Vanessa Redgrave, and it's directed by Mark Rylance. Phil, tell us more about this and what you thought about this production.
Well, I really didn't like it. And the reason I didn't like it was because of the two leads, their lack of grasp on the text, basically. There were 10 of us that went, and at the interval we were all saying that for the first 20 minutes to half an hour, we were really struggling to hear what they were saying. I mean, that's actually not just the two leads. It was very underpowered, but especially those two. They both had a strange delivery, I think because they just didn't seem to know their lines or were struggling to remember them. So they would pause in strange places or they would swallow their words. And it meant actually listening to what the line was very difficult to understand, because it's Shakespeare and it's sometimes quite hard anyway. So quite a bit. I have seen Much Ado before relatively recently with David Tennant and Catherine Tate, so I kind of know the plot, fortunately. But bits of it were lost to me because I just wasn't understanding it. Having said that, I do think that James Earl Jones, eventually, once he got his sort of act together, he's such a charming presence on stage and he's so charismatic that you really do end up really liking him. I can't say the same for Vanessa Redgrave. And there was a scene towards the end of the first act where both of them, Beatrice and Benedict, are sort of tricked into believing that the other one is in love with each other. And I thought those scenes were really very effective. And I thought, oh, this is going to pick up now. But the second act, actually, I found quite tedious. It wasn't the fault of the other people in the cast. There was a prompt, which I've never seen before, sitting in the centre of the front row, who was only actually used once for James Earl Jones. But I was on the edge of my seat with whether they were actually going to get to the end of their line, let alone the end of the play. And Alt's set, I did actually, when I walked in and I saw it, I thought, well, that's very attractive. It's a very stylish set. But it's too static. It doesn't do anything. And in the second act, the front of it is covered with a black cloth, which forces all the action to the very front of the stage. And when the cloth went up, I thought, oh, they're going to have done something with the set underneath this sort of veneered arch in the middle. But no, it was just a few seats and people shrouded in for the wedding scene. So I just found that very static. And also it's done in very even lighting, a bit like The Globe, which sort of shows Mark Rylance's sort of influence, which I thought didn't create an atmosphere for the whole thing. And people were falling asleep all over the place. There were two people in the boxes asleep. There's about three people in my row, and we were quite near the front. So goodness knows how many other people in the thing. I thought it was a mess.
Yeah, I agree. I just couldn't believe what I was watching. I think the whole thing, I mean, even the other actors were that good. You know, sometimes you can have some weaknesses, but other parts of the production pull it up a little bit. It felt to me like they'd kind of just learnt the lines. They were just being sent on stage and they were just, right, let's try and do something. There were some odd, funny moments, for example, in The Watch, where they ripped down Dogberry as an ass and the little boy kept saying, but you are an ass. But after five times of doing that, it wasn't funny anymore. And being upstaged by borrowing the chair out of the audience, if that was the best moment in the whole production, I think they've got a real problem on their hands. I mean, there were things like, I couldn't understand why Beatrice, who was supposed to be in mourning in the final wedding scene, was dressed as a land girl at that point. It just didn't make sense. I just think the whole thing was stilted, lines were thrown away. And I suppose it's because I've got in my head, I've actually got the Windham's production and the recent RSC production, and two very different productions that made a lot of the lines and pauses in the right place to draw the audience in. And just to hear these lines just being said in a really deadpan way was so disappointing. I just couldn't believe that I'd paid all that money to see something that's probably one of the worst Shakespeare productions I've ever seen.
When did you see it, Julie?
Yesterday afternoon.
Oh, so that's yesterday, because I saw it on Monday, which was obviously an earlier preview, so it sounds like they're not getting it together. Or maybe they'll get it together by the time it opens, but it had no sparkle for me.
Yeah. I mean, the gullying scenes are the ones where if your audience is unsure and they're not an audience that are used to Shakespeare, if you've got a good Beatrice and a good Benedict, you're using those soliloquies, draw the audience in. And I remember David Tennant really working the audience at that point. And in this, they were stood there even where the hid wasn't funny. And because they had the box in a box, there was points when Vanessa Redgrave went round the back of it and you couldn't see her.
Yeah,
so the
absolutely.
Idea that she was watching and you watch them, and that's the funny bit, you see their reactions. If you can't see them reacting, then it's not funny at all. It's just, and I was sat in the middle of the stall, so I had a really good seat. And if I had blind spots with the best seats, I don't know what chance anybody had.
No, I was going to say, I had the same problem. I had a fairly central stall seat about five rows from the front. And although I thought those were the best scenes in it, it was very annoying not being able to see either Beatrice or Benedict in those scenes where that you're meant to be able to see them. They had to keep sort of poking their head around so you could see them. And some of the audience, obviously, depending on where you sat, could see them. So they were laughing and you were thinking, well, what are they laughing at? Because we can't see them.
I mean, obviously, they have to cut the line, you know, the world must be peopled. But then if you're going to cut lines like that, you've got to build it up to a crescendo. You've got to build it up to a moment. I mean, I think it was fairly amusing when she came out with the carving knife. But you need more than that. You need the whole scene, you know, his kind of buffoonery that he suddenly realised is in love, she doesn't. It was just like, so what's going on now? They lost every time. They lost the kind of build and they lost the energy. It just dragged and dragged. And people left all around me. I was sat in an expensive stall seat with two people at the end of the row after the interval because people had walked out. So it's not good.
I completely agree. Tim, what did you think?
I think I must have enjoyed it more than you. I don't know if you've seen Vanessa Redgrave on stage before, because I thought it was a fairly typical Vanessa Redgrave performance in many ways. And it's the thing that Vanessa Redgrave does is she's so relaxed on stage, and it's just as if she speaks as if the lines have just occurred to her. And it's not that she's forgotten the lines. It is the, you know, she tries to it's one of the things she does. It is the Vanessa Redgrave thing, I think, from certainly only from the things I've seen before. And so when I was watching her, I thought it was a very typical one. Of course, it doesn't really match with all the other performances. And also, I thought James Earl Jones was doing it, although, but I did suspect, I don't know the play completely that well. I have seen it quite a few times, but I don't know the lines that well. But I did think he was missing bits occasionally, and people were coping. Certainly the whole poetry scene where he tries to rhyme lady with baby, that was not there. Yeah. And but the line that the world should be peopled was, so I think there are one or two sort of sudden jump cuts that people are coping with, and on a particularly bad day it could be really rather bad. I mean, it is a pity, because I would have much rather have seen them do this 20 years ago when they were not sort of, what is it, 78 and 81 or something. I mean, they are both quite old now, and it doesn't quite work together. It's a neat idea, but it doesn't, that bit doesn't quite work, and they're in a different play to everybody else. And I think the rest of the play is really quite good. Myself, I love the setting. The setting is, which nobody's mentioned, I don't think, you're basically in an English country house during World War II, and the airmen are pretty much all black, like the Tuskegee Airmen or bomber pilots. So we get this influx of young actors. I mean, in the cast we have James Garnon, who is the sort of the white commander of all the black pilots, and he's, I thought he was good. I mean, he's an extremely good Globe standby, and is always worth watching. And I thought he was very good in this. I mean, I didn't recognise him for the first few minutes, because I thought they just imported an American in to do the role. But maybe I was wrong. I liked actually the way they did the watch. I thought it was quite a neat idea to do the watch with a couple of Boy Scouts doing the actual arrest. Hugh Oatcake and George Seacole are played by a number of children, so it might be how well those children are behaving affects how good the play is and how good those bits were. I thought I got some pretty good ones. It's noticeable that you do have a slightly older young girl, Catherine Carlton, who's cast as somebody called Beryl, who's an invented character. She's there, I think, to make sure that they behave and they remember their lines, and she's there to slip things in. So I think there is a little bit of that kind of improvisation. And I do think that Peter White and Tim Barlow as Dogberry and Verges, I liked them. It was a nice concept to have him being the village Bobby and Verges being a Salvation Army man. They made quite a good double act, but they didn't overplay it. And that was actually, for us, it was quite fun. You know, when I saw it, it was quite funny. Now, we certainly did get some walkouts. I think I lost four people sitting next to me, and I was in a fairly good seat. So it was, there were some walkouts, and people weren't happy. And Phil, you're quite right to say that there were occasions where James Earl Jones was vaguely incoherent. I mean, he just swallowed his lines, and it was such a pity. And you just wish that it was it's a nice idea, it's a nice try, and it's a problem it's going on till November. I hope they work it out, but it's almost a stunt. It's stunt casting, isn't it? And I'm not sure that that's worked. But I still quite liked my time there, but I just wished I'd seen it sort of 20 years ago, I think.
I think, though, they're going to have to do a lot of work to get it better. A lot of work. I mean, if we're just picking odd moments out of it to go, well, that was okay. And I get the point about Vanessa Redgrave looking like she's just thought of the line, but in a way, that's how you should act Shakespeare. And there was no response to that. It wasn't as if there was a dialogue or any chemistry. So the scene in the church, the Kill Claudius scene, there was a moment where I thought, actually, these two people are in love with each other, and have just realised that, because it was as if they were just saying lines at each other that could have been any line.
I think the whole thing with her making it seem as though the line has just come into her head just doesn't work with this, because it just made it very difficult to understand the line, because the pauses all seem to be in the wrong place. I don't know if they've kind of worked on that since I saw it, but that's how it was on Monday night. I thought it was just, and all right, you can say it was a preview, but we were still paying a lot of money for it. It felt very under-rehearsed.
Well, I paid the same amount of money for that preview as I'm paying to see the RSC in Stratford, actually a lot more, and I'm seeing wonderful performances for a lot less. It's just not right, really. I mean, we were talking about the Old Vic, and apart from the Richard III, I rarely see a very good Shakespeare there. So maybe they need to rethink what they're doing.
We're now going to talk about Blue Stockings at the Shakespeare's Globe. This is a new play by Jessica Swale, directed by John Dove. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, the play is set at the end of the 19th century in Cambridge. And I think it's a very interesting piece of history that I frankly didn't know very much at all, really, where women were studying at Girton College within the university. And indeed, some of their lecturers were sort of coming in from other colleges, but they weren't allowed to graduate from university. So they were sort of certainly in educational terms very much second class. And they were pushing for a Senate vote, a university Senate vote, in order to get the right to graduate. So the play is kind of centred around that period just before and after the vote. And it sort of shows us what these women are trying to do and trying to achieve. And they're quite a feisty bunch, really, but also shows us the attitudes of the men, university men, educated men. And I think it's very timely because there is a lot of issue in the Middle East and Central Asia about the education of women. And some of what you hear coming out of the mouths of these late 19th century intelligent, educated Cambridge dons isn't that dissimilar to what you hear coming out of the Taliban, really. And it did take until it took another 50 years before women were allowed to graduate. So even though, you know, this takes place at the end of the 19th century, it's actually another 50 years before they're allowed to graduate. So it was a struggle that went on much longer and went on way beyond the suffragette movement. I think it's a really interesting subject to make a play out of. And Jessica Swale, who I know has directed a lot of plays but hasn't written a play until now, has done, I think, a really good job because it's clearly well researched. But I think what makes it a good job is she's taken this subject and made it interesting and indeed, you know, one that does resonate today. But she also makes it very entertaining. You know, it is a very entertaining piece. There's lots of humanity in it, lots of humour in it, and a kind of playfulness about it. And it really sits comfortably on that Globe stage. I don't know whether it's because of the period, whether it's late 19th century, whether it's the subject matter or whatever. But it really fits the Globe. It fits the Globe extremely well. So I enjoyed it very much. And, you know, I think for a debut play, I think it's an exceptional achievement. John Dove does a very good job of giving it a sort of zippy, pacey style. There's a nice use of music. There's a trio of two brass and keyboard or two brass and percussion, depending on what they're doing, who start the play off and turn up every now and again, which is very effective. And it uses the space extremely well. So I think of all the new plays they've done at the Globe, and I've seen a lot of them, I think this is actually one of the best. I think it fits the Globe very well. It's a good subject and good piece of writing. It's very well put together and very well performed. So something to be recommended for me.
I agree. I mean, I think it is very good. I'm a bit of a fan of Jessica Swale, I have to say. Certainly her directing work. She's got quite a knack for directing, and especially rediscovering old plays, although I have seen the last thing she directed at the Globe was Bedlam, which was a new play. So she certainly knows her way round the theatre. As you said, it does work very well in this space. I do have a slight problem with the notion of it. It's only politically. I mean, we are in a situation, certainly in this country, where the only problem with educated women is there probably aren't enough of them, or at least, you know, the sort of people I know have that opinion, and certainly I share that. So anything anybody says against the education of women, we are against. So you approach it from that. And I was very worried when I came to this play that I might be getting this sort of 20/20 hindsight, that they are completely rotten and, you know, anybody who thinks differently. But these were people, I mean, as bad as their opinions sound now, they were honest opinions. I mean, they were saying women, educated women have no place in our society. This is you know, late 19th century society, as opposed to now, when they do, of course, have a place. It necessitated a change in
the whole of society in order to get the acceptance of educated women. I'm old enough to remember that there were still places where people say, you know, women don't have the brains to do things, even in this country, even in some professions, you know, up until quite recently. Well, they are definitely on the losing side. But at the late 19th century, they weren't on the losing side because that was actually true. And this is something, fortunately, that this play deals with. But the idea is that even if you get an education, even if you got a degree, what was there for you to do? What was there for a woman to do? What could she do in society? She had nothing to do. And it doesn't really deal with that it, you know, needed a societal change. But I did like the way that Jessica Swell addressed this problem with these. We start off with four girls. She also seems to be in some of the reviews rather interested in class and saying that perhaps one of the problems that people have with Girton especially is that they will take any smart young girl. So we have in this play a young woman who is part of a large Irish family, and she has to go back to looking after the family when the mother dies, and she sort of has to go back and look after her very young sort of brothers and sisters, and she loses out on what could be an extremely good piece. And another thing I liked about this play was that they do the examination, the TRIPOS examination, which they were allowed to take, but they weren't allowed to sort of, it didn't count for anything, but yeah. They would have got their degree, the male undergraduates would have got their degrees, but the women didn't. But it was a way they do that very nice idea of that, I keep wanting to say Socratic method, but I don't think it is, but it's the idea that you are interrogated about your subject orally. And you just have to justify it and get all your arguments across properly. And it's a way. I knew they did education like this, but I'd never really seen it before, and it was very interesting. But yeah, it is a very interesting piece. And I mean, I'm just a bit worried about this. I'm always a little bit worried about sort of the politics of it, because I think, is it something that, if this sort of subject goes away, is it something that's going to last? I'm not sure that it's a sort of a lasting play, although it's a good play and a timely play and very well put together and done.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't feel the same way about the politics of it, really, because I don't think it's really a political play. I think what it's showing is a society where, you know, where there is an imbalance, and men, frankly, you know, were trying to keep women in their place, as indeed in some societies still today it's happening. And I think some of the attitudes, I mean, you still hear some of these things today, clearly from fewer people, and it doesn't happen anything like the same way as it did even 20, 30 years ago. But I still think it's very interesting to look at the motivations behind, you know, why this was happening. And I don't think it's political. It's more sociological than it is political, I think. And I do think there are parallels. I do think it is a very timely play, because I do think, you know, there are parallels with what's going on in some parts of the world today, in the same way as when I saw The Pride. It was parallels there because of what was happening in Russia at this time. And I think it's very easy for us to be complacent that we've moved on in some societies, but in many other societies we haven't moved on at all. And indeed, have we moved on enough? So I thought it was thought-provoking, but I didn't think it was overtly political. And I thought they handled that very well. What was interesting about coming up to the Senate vote, what was interesting is how the conflict moved outside the university and perhaps became less, the arguments perhaps became less reasoned when it was kind of people out there on the street, as it were, people out there in society who were objecting to this rather than the learned men themselves inside the institution. But, you know, I think it's an interesting piece of history, very, very well researched, I think, very well researched and very well written. But as I said, I think she has managed to make it a very entertaining play. And one of the things I really liked about seeing it on Thursday night was it was a full house and it was a very young audience. And the Globe has been getting younger and younger audiences. And I do find it a very energising place to go and see theatre. You know, you go to somewhere like Hampstead and, you know, even I'm in danger of bringing the age down. And then you go into somewhere like the Globe or indeed the Young Vic, and it's kind of buzzing. And it really felt like that on Thursday night. And I think that's just terrific.
We're now going to talk about On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. This is a musical by Burton Lane with book and lyrics by Alan J. Lerner. It's directed here by Kirk Jameson at the Union Theatre. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
This is a musical with a really odd plot. It's a little bit about ESP, it's a little bit about psychotherapy, it's a little bit about past lives and reincarnation. And you could really hardly ask for anything to be more 60s. I'm glad I didn't know what it was about before I went, because it would have kept me from going. And as it turns out, this is an incredibly fun musical, and it's done very well. The essential plot is that a young woman, Daisy Gamble, who's played by Vicki Lee Taylor, who was just in Chorus Line, is in a psychiatrist's office while he's teaching a class, and she's inadvertently hypnotized. Psychologist Dr. Mark Bruckner, who's played by Nadine Crowe, becomes fascinated in her because while he's trying to snap her out of the hypnosis, it turns out that she's a little psychic. But it seems very normal because all she's done is tell him, like, where to find his car keys, essentially. And that's not the kind of thing that seems, like, really special, except that she's told him where to find a note that he's been looking for, and she's actually told him exactly in what book to look for it, and obviously something that was completely impossible. But because the whole situation is transitioned into so gently, as an audience member, you are taken along this journey into Cloud Cuckoo Land without a lot of fuss. It's done in a wonderful 60s fashion with all sorts of mini skirts and some go-go dancing. And I think actually part of the reason why it works so well for me is because Vicki Lee Taylor looked exactly like she was right out of Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Same kind of big poofy hair, beautiful creamy complexion and pink lipstick. And it just felt really right. The way the plot goes on, I'm not entirely sure how much I should share, but while she's under hypnosis, she starts talking about some past life that she's had. And the psychologist, who initially has been very disinterested in her and her strange abilities, becomes fascinated by this life that he's able to research independently and verify is an actual person. So Daisy herself is a completely boring, middle-of-the-road girl who just wants to make her boyfriend happy, and her boyfriend's really kind of a cad because all he wants to do, basically, is fit in with everything that the majority is doing. He wants to be bland and normal, and because of him, Daisy's embarrassed by the things that she can do. So there's a conflict with Daisy and her boyfriend, and then there's the scenes in which Daisy is talking about her past life with Dr. Bruckner, and the past life is actually recreated on the stage. So you get to see the boyfriend that she rejected, the artist she fell in love with, her family, and all these other things. And that story of the past life isn't really particularly interesting, and not a lot of weight is put on it in the musical, but it does give it does make the modern day scenes, you know, much more interesting. There's some really, really good songs. Apparently the first real big song is the one that Daisy sings to her plants to help them grow. And I mean, I tell you, when I talk about this, it sounds ridiculous. I mean, what kind of a song is that? To be honest, Feed Me Seymour seems more likely than I'm going to think some thought waves at these plants and make them grow. But the song, Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here, is just so sweet. It is a lovely song. I can't believe I've never heard it before, because it would be a wonderful cabaret song. And it turns out that this song, it was actually the one that was kind of written before the musical was written. So it was like kind of like one of the key songs that it was built around. And it's a wonderful showpiece number. Vicki Lee Taylor has absolutely got the pipes and the personality to pull this show off as the lead. And while some of the characters who were playing the sort of like 18th century characters, some of the actors who were playing the 18th century characters aren't as personable, none of them has a bad voice or anything, but she is 5-star top of the game, exactly the kind of triple threat actress that you go to the union hoping to see. Because I got to listen to her, you know, singing from about 5 feet away, and I just could have sat there all night. So, in conclusion, for all that this play seems like possibly the most boring, unpromising, get your back up, hippy drippy garbage, it actually winds up being such a refreshing change of pace with a very, very novel topic. And it's performed extremely well and has some very, very good songs in it that, you know, if you've heard any of them before, you've probably never actually seen them done in context. So my trip to the Union Theater to see On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever absolutely, absolutely was worth the time. And I've been recommending it to people as a far better way to spend your evening than paying 6 times the price up the street to go watch James Earl Jones and Vanessa Redgrave stumble their way through Much Ado About Nothing.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both Stitcher and iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.